Hey everyone, this is Derek Bros with the Conscious Resistance Network, and today I'm talking with you about the 10-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. Now, some of you haven't been following me probably since 2013 and might not remember that I actually was in Boston right after the bombing. I was there during the lockdowns, the manhunt for the two alleged terrorists behind the attack. And I actually documented with some original footage. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the remaining holes in the official story that exist 10 years later and why you, generally speaking, should have questions about the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Derek Bros. This is Derek Bros of the Conscious Resistance. I'm here in Standing Rock.
That man is wanted in 5 different countries: Chile, Argentina, Brazil.
We've been fighting a long time. We've all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone.
Don't you fucking tease that horn!
You are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Alright, welcome back everyone. First off, I want to remind you guys to visit my website, theconsciousresistance.com. Theconsciousresistance.com. This is the best place to get all of my content, everything that I've created over the last 13 years, going on 14 years now. And you will find, when this video comes out, you'll find the latest post, which has the links to all of the articles we're going to go over tonight. And make sure you follow through there and do your own research. I will remind you guys, if you want to support my work, you can go to theconsciousresistance.com/invest. This is our page where you can find out more. We have a P.O. box if you want to send checks, equipment, love mail. If you got crypto addresses, you can send us crypto for support. And I recently just launched again a Buy Me a Coffee page. For those who are unaware, this is an alternative to Patreon. I'm not supporting Patreon. I'm not on PayPal. So if you want to support me, the only way to do so, besides the ways I just mentioned, would be at the Conscious Resistance page, the Derek Bros page on Buy Me a Coffee. And you can support for as little as $3 a month if you want to do that. And then one other thing, if you'd like to, you can buy shirts like this, No Masters, No Slaves, off our store. You can also buy my books, which you see right here, if you want to support. Those are the best ways besides just sharing my content to get the word out. So let's go ahead and look at this. Look, in 2013, this is my old YouTube channel. This is a much younger looking Derek Bros with a pulled back mohawk right there and hair on the side that's a little too long. This was April 16, 2013. So literally 10 years and 2 weeks ago. And this is my, what I call the conscious report as I was preparing. I was just days away from going to Boston to cover what happened. And this is also literally days after the bombing of the marathon itself took place. So that's me right back then getting ready to go cover it. Now, what I'm going to show you guys real quick before we get into the actual evidence and the questions that surround the Boston bombing, I'm going to show you my original report that I did for the Houston Freethinkers YouTube channel. These are old YouTube channels that I used before Derek Bros Live Free and then the Houston Freethinkers, which was an activist group I started in 2010, which existed till about 2018 or so. Myself and Cody Adams, shout out to Cody, who was my friend slash cameraman, activist, ally, traveled with me to New York City to cover these events. And this, what we're about to show you right now, is some of the footage that we took place. And I'm not going to show you the whole thing. It's about 8, 9, 10 minutes that we're going to play. But go ahead and follow through this and you can see, again, the questions that we were asking on the ground as the entire city of Boston turned into a police state. Pretty crazy to be there and see in first person. But go ahead and check this out and we'll be right back. This is Derek Bros with the IntelliHub and the Houston Freethinkers live in Boston, Massachusetts. We are here at the site of the Boston Marathon bombings that took place this past Monday, where 3 people were murdered and over 170 people were injured. We're here to investigate, to ask questions, to find out exactly what's going on. We just spoke to some people on the streets who are giving us information about a third explosion that they heard and other undetonated bombs that are going ignored by the mainstream media. Now today, the FBI, they've announced that there are personnel that they're looking for. There's certain people of interest that they found in the videos that they want to question either because of their proximity to the blast or because of possible connections to it. So we're here to ask questions. We're here to find more information about it and to find why these leads
such as undetonated bombs and the Saudi national that was all of a sudden deported for national security reasons, why these things are taking place and why the mainstream media is not asking these questions. And as you can see, there's a heavy military presence around the city. We're going to go check out the memorial and bring you more information. Please stay tuned.
Cloudy right now, but maybe somewhere between like 3:20 and 3:45, no doubt we heard an explosion. So there were the two explosions, but much later we heard a third explosion. So I don't know, I don't hear them talking about it on the news, but so you're the first person who's mentioned that to me. I thought that our interpretation of that was that there was a controlled explosion of one of the undetonated devices.
Yeah,
but
I
don't know.
Other ones.
Yeah, they're not really talking about that.
I mentioned what she's talking about to a reporter, and the reporter told me that they were told, that she thinks, from what I said, that they were told by the police that it was a water cannon. And they said that's all they said. They didn't say why they were using it or why it sounds like an explosion, but that's what she told me. You can ask the other reporters what they know about that. But there are more explosions, not just bombs, but there are actual explosions afterwards.
Two explosions. There was seven.
At least one. Yeah.
That I was definitely on the street and heard an enormous sound. I would guess somewhere between like 3:20 and 3:40 or 3:50 on that day. Supposedly 2:50, about 15 seconds apart. Yeah, so maybe about a half an hour later, or maybe 40 minutes later. I know that when we were walking home, they had. Everyone was on their smartphones, and they had announced that all the T stations, the public transportation, was on a lockdown or shutdown. So we just walked, and when we were walking, we definitely heard it.
You were in this area, walking away from.
I was probably walking down Comm Ave at the time, away from the scene.
Oh, so you're leaving the scene, and you heard it like back in the direction of the scene.
Yes.
Okay, so it's still in the same area.
Yeah, it was definitely still in the same area. And, there were lots of people.
About the JFK thing.
Yeah, so
you are distinguishing between the JFK controlled, detonation or whatever.
That was a fire. That was a control that happened at JFK.
The JFK library thing?
Yeah, yeah. Something else. They say it was unrelated. But it was a real fire, I think.
We just want to show, as we're walking and rushing to the city, how ghost town like it is. No one's on the streets, nothing's open.
We're checking trucks for explosives, possible explosives.
Here we are approaching the scene, getting as close as we can. It is our right to be able to film, exercising that right.
Thank you for your support.
Secret Service. yelled at by people on the roof.
How you doing? This is Derek with the Intel Hub and the Houston Freethinkers. We are here on Arsenal Street in Watertown in the Boston area. We are about as close as we can get with the media. As you can see, there's plenty of police presence out here. Last night, two suspects involved in the Boston Marathon were identified. There was a chase ensued where one of the suspects was killed in a shootout on the MIT campus. Now the remaining suspect, who is a 19-year-old Chechenian citizen who's been living here in America, is somewhere in this area, they say. Police are everywhere. There's helicopters above, there's snipers, they're keeping everybody as far away as possible. We're going to keep asking questions, find out what we can. There seems to be some movement taking place, so we're going to keep an eye on the situation. Stay tuned.
Blackhawks are here.
They're landing, dude.
Yeah, they're touching down.
So it's like, it was fucking some type of military operation that maybe these guys thought they were really going to do a bomb set up, you know? And these guys kind of fed them. The FBI does it all the time. CIA, they set up people. They give them fake bombs, and then they let them do their little thing, and then they catch them.
They got a guy. They're searching him.
National Guard finally got what they wanted. Martial law in Boston. Anyway.
All right, so as you heard there in that video, there were questions surrounding second devices being exploded, fires, reports of additional explosions, all the usual telltale signs that we've seen in things like the Oklahoma City bombing and the 9/11 false flag, and in so many other examples where there's these, I don't know, there's like these characteristics that some of us, we're called conspiracy realists, who ask questions and say, I wonder how many times a certain characteristic has to be placed in these major world events before we ask ourselves, is that a sign? Is that you know something we should pay attention to? So we're going to go through some of those things, starting with the reports of drills taking place a year before the Boston Marathon bombing. Now, this is an article which you're seeing on screen that I wrote in July 2021, so 2 years ago. Why are conspiracy theorists worried about an impending power grid failure? And for those of you, you might remember that the World Economic Forum, they were about to have their cyber polygon simulation simulating a potential power grid failure. And there was a number of independent journalists and people in the alternative media who were kind of like on edge, like, oh my God, is the power going to go down? You know, there's always these fears that the power is going down. It may happen one day, guys, but don't live in fear. And this article itself was saying, okay, well, why is it that people have these concerns? And again, well, the World Economic Forum's meeting, they're having Cyberpolygon exercise. We know that they were at least part of the Event 201 exercise, and that was before COVID. So people are skeptical, they're curious, they're concerned. And what I did is I go through in this article, I actually interviewed Christian Westbrook, Ice Age Farmer. Shout out to him. He's alive. He's okay. And Dan Dix of Press for Truth about their perspective on this, because they are two of the people I've seen who's been calling this out back then. But the reason I brought this up is because not only do we have Event 201, we got exercises like Crimson Contagion, Clade X, all kinds of other exercises simulating the SPARS pandemic, which I was the first one to report on back in 2020, that show that they are, at the very least, they're doing exercises, they're doing drills, and for whatever reason, these drills often precede real-world events. I don't claim to know why, I'm just saying it seems to happen. So people like Christian Ice Age Farmer started to look in the fact that there have been these other exercises. There's the so-called food reaction game that the Rockefellers held. There was other exercises specifically about food that Christian was paying attention to. And then, of course, you've got like the 9/11 war games, which James Corbett and many of other people have written about and talked about and reported on, that there were drills literally practicing, pretending that there was hijacked planes flying around at the exact same time of 9/11. Oh, my God. And then the 7/7 attacks in London, July 7, 2005, there was actually there was an exercise that involved a series of four coordinated suicide attacks that turned from a simulation into a real situation in real time. And that one's crazy because you even have some of the crisis management behind the simulation drill saying like, wow, we never would have imagined that the exercise we were doing would mimic real world events. So clearly there's reasons to be skeptical. And this brings us to the Boston Marathon bombing. Boston 25 News reported that, quote, the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, MEMA, trained for a potential bombing at the Boston Marathon 1 year prior to the April 15 attacks that killed three and injured hundreds more. The drills happened at least twice before the bombing, and one scenario involved a bombing occurring at the finish line beneath a spectator grandstand. So, again, not just them simulating a bomb happening in Boston a year before, which would have been odd enough, but a bomb in Boston at the marathon exactly 1 year before, and they've done it at least twice before. And the spokesperson for MEMA said that they've been conducting these exercises since, you guessed it, 9/11. And the independent research community thinks that these exercises were actually going live. So maybe some people believe that they were doing a simulated drill of some kind, and then others were aware of what was really going on. And in the chaos, once things went live, i.e. the bombs went off and exploded, people, there is real chaos, there is real confusion, but there are some people who are actually in the know and understand what's taking place. So that's one element, the drills taking place before the actual event. It seems to be a telltale sign of a false flag event. At least it pops up fairly often in other situations. Now let's move to some other bits of evidence specifically related to the brother Tamerlan, and I still don't know how to pronounce their names correctly, Sarnav, I'm just going to avoid mispronouncing it, but you guys know who I'm talking about. Tamerlan and his brother were the two brothers who were accused of pulling off this Boston Marathon bombing. For those who don't know, I guess we should have said this in the beginning, but hopefully you're at least aware of the basic story. The Boston Marathon bombing, bombs exploded in the near the finish line. These two brothers, Chechen brothers, are claimed to have claimed responsibility. One of them ends up dying in the pursuit by the police, being killed and ran over. And then the other one is now waiting in prison. And as far as I know, no one's allowed to visit him. He's like on a strict, strict kind of gag by the FBI, which is just insane to think, like, if this guy really was a patsy, like many people suspect, he's just rotting away in a maximum security prison, not allowed to talk to anybody, and the real story will never come out. It's pretty insane to think about that. So let's get into this. Was Tamerlan a federal informant? This is one of the big pieces of news that has come out in recent years, and there's a bit of evidence. So we'll talk about that here in just a moment. Here, I'm going to move this link over here. On April 15th, 2013, Tamerlan and his younger brother, Zokar attacked the Boston Marathon. It was one of the worst terrorist attacks on U.S. soil since 9/11. In all, they killed four people and injured hundreds more. One of the most intense manhunts in recent history culminated in a violent shootout with police in Watertown. That's where I was in Boston, in the Boston area, Watertown, on April 19th. Tamerlan was killed in that shootout. Zokar was arrested 2 years later. He was tried on federal terrorism charges. He was found guilty of the bombing and formally sentenced to death. Now, that sentence was later recanted, but then there was an appeal, and then it was reinstated. So he is still sentenced to die. 4 years after the bombing, after a high-profile federal terrorism trial and multiple government investigations, there are still many unanswered questions, particularly about Tamerlan. In this special report, we'll investigate some of the most controversial unanswered questions. They include, was he a federal informant? How does the federal informant program work? How do federal agencies recruit Muslims and other immigrants to become informants? And did Tamerlan receive special treatment through his program for his application to become a U.S. citizen? So there's a lot of theories that maybe he became an informant to help them out because they promised him that he could get U.S. citizenship and they were using him. And then again, exercise went live, and all of a sudden him and his brother are being blamed for being behind the attack, and they're being chased around. They're probably like, what the hell? Like, if they really had nothing to do with it. And eventually he's killed, and then the younger brother is arrested, right? Well, in 2014, Zokar, the younger brother, as he prepared his defense, his lawyers filed a motion which sought all documents relating to FBI contact with Tamerlan. Why? Because they believed Tamerlan had been a federal informant. They wrote, quote, "We base this on information from our client's family and other sources that the FBI made more than one visit to talk with Tamerlan and asked him to be an informant, reporting on the Chechen and Muslim community." So that was in court records. It doesn't mean it was 100% factual. We don't know. Of course, the FBI themselves has put out statements denying, claiming like, no, we didn't do anything. Just in case you're curious, here's the FBI statement. Joint release, where the only thing they really said was, to be absolutely clear, no one was surveying them and they were not identified until after the shootout. Any claims to the contrary are false. So the usual deny, deny, deny. Anybody saying otherwise is crazy. So they are not claiming responsibility for him. They're saying that they were never sources for the FBI, nor did they attempt to recruit them as sources. But again, there's so many examples of this in the post 9/11 world. You could even go back and I think 2011, find a New York Times article that said that the FBI is entrapping terror suspects. Like, literally, that was the straight to the point headline. You wouldn't see that anymore. But they also mentioned here a book by Michelle McPhee, Maximum Harm, The Sarnoff Brothers, the FBI, and the Road to the Marathon Bombing, where she says, quote, "Tamerlan was the perfect recruit. He had tentacles in the drug world. He spoke multiple languages. He could mix in anywhere. He was tall and handsome. He had an American wife. Here was a guy that really was the perfect recruit." So this is an Emmy-nominated investigative journalist, longtime journalist, worked for the Boston Herald, and has done a lot of good work. And she put this book out, Maximum Harm, and she basically gets together her law enforcement sources and new evidence that she says point to the fact that federal authorities offered to help him to become a U.S. citizen in exchange for being an informant. You help us, we will help you, is what she claims. So that's one little bit of evidence, like, okay, there's some strong claims that he was an FBI informant. Here's another one from Who, What, Why. Was Tamerlan an FBI informant? Odd say it's possible. Again, they kind of go into some of the different pieces. I will link all this stuff up for you guys. But here's some more background for those who are just not familiar with how the FBI works, or maybe you just think I'm some crazy conspiracy theorist who doesn't know what he's talking about. According to Trevor Aronson, the author of Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, nearly half of the 508 defendants prosecuted for terrorism-related incidents between 9/11 and 2011 were prompted to by acts of informants who were paid as much as $100,000 per assignment. Sting operations resulted in the prosecution of 158 defendants. Among the most high-profile plots of the last decade investigated by Aronson, only three lacked FBI involvement. Tamerlan was an out-of-work boxer married to a nurse's aide who worked 60 hours a week to make ends meet. How he could come up with $900 cash to send his mother in Russia 2 days before the bombing and afford to buy several backpacks and ammunition, BBs, and other supposed bomb-making material was never answered during the trial. Whether he participated in something illegal or earned the cash in some other manner was not explored. Interesting stuff, right? And also they say there's a weird fact that all the receipts, the only receipts found in Tamerlan's wallet were those that showed specifically his purchase of materials related to bombing. So that's very convenient for them, isn't it? And this article goes further into the bombs, the trips, just some of the discrepancies about this that don't make sense. I encourage you to read all of these. Again, these are going to be linked in the comments. And here's another one, exclusive. Relatives of Boston Marathon bomber break their silence. And this is coming from Time Magazine, as I said. And this is just more info, more data from his family themselves saying that they believe that he was an informant and, you know, that they don't think that they did these crimes. And you could say, of course, someone's parents are going to protect them. But when the parents confirmed what the book was saying, this other book we just talked about, Maximum Harm, that they had been visited by the FBI in the months leading up to the incident, I think that's something we ought to pay attention to. So maybe we should think about that. I'll put that one in the show notes as well. Here's another one I found that these are some other interesting angles here, okay? Two other things that don't add up. Boston bomber suspected in triple homicide. This is just literally 10 years ago. This is a week after the Boston Marathon bombing. Two of the slain men in 2011 were Jewish. Interesting angle here, okay? What is this about? An ABC report says that authorities believe that Tamerlan Sarnov, the older suspect in the attack who died in a shootout with police, may have been responsible for a triple homicide back in 2011. Remember, Tamerlan's the brother that we are being told was the FBI agent, or FBI informant. He died in a shootout with the police, allegedly, which means he couldn't speak about any sort of relationship he had with them. The other brother's locked in maximum security prison and can't speak with us about what happened. But this report is saying that he was suspected of being involved in a triple homicide. Three people were killed, including one of his friends and somebody who he knew at an MMA gym. So that he knew this guy. The investigation of the extremely grisly murders yielded few leads over the course of the past year. But according to new accounts, this guy, one of the guys who was killed, he lived near Tamerlan, and he may have been, you know, connected. Tamerlan may have been connected. So imagine this. We don't know the details. Tamerlan's a MMA fighter. His friend's an MMA fighter. He allegedly was suspected of being involved in this murder. Obviously, he's dead now, so there's no, you know, there's nothing they can do about it then. But think about this. What if he was somehow implicated or involved in this murder, this triple homicide, back in 2011? And then at some point, he's also looking to become U.S. citizen. And at some point, somehow, he becomes in touch with an FBI agent or somebody claiming they represent the FBI. Maybe they took him in for questioning for this triple homicide and realized that he could be a valuable asset. Then holding this triple homicide over his head or holding his U.S. citizenship over his head, they offer for him to be an informant. That is how these things work, guys. They use the legal system against you to make you bend to their will. That's what they do. So I think it's very plausible and possible that the U.S. citizenship angle we already know is being put together in some circles. I'm proposing that maybe this involvement in this triple homicide may have also played a role in him becoming a federal informant. Just something else to think about. Now here's another weird angle. Man linked to Boston suspect killed by the FBI. Why are all these people turning up dead? Florida man shot dead after he got violent during questioning about his possible links to blast suspects. This is what they're claiming. This is May 22, 2013. So about a month after the Boston Marathon bombing happened, an FBI agent has shot and killed a Florida man who, quote, turned violent while being questioned about the Boston Marathon bombings, the FBI said. A friend of the dead man told the Orlando Sentinel and Orlando TV stations that he was 27-year-old Ibrahim Todashev of Orlando, a Chechen who had previously lived in Boston. Two brothers identified by the FBI as suspects in the April 15th bombings were also of Chechen origin. So they're saying, hey, this guy was being questioned in Florida because he allegedly knew one of the brothers. He's Chechen. He had lived in Boston before. And apparently during that questioning, he, what do they say? Turned violent, and then they had to kill him. The FBI said in a statement that a special agent, quote, acting on the imminent threat posed by the individual, responded with deadly force. The individual was killed, and the special agent was transported to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries, end quote. They said this took place in Florida, where the special agent and law enforcement agents were interviewing the man about the blast that killed people at the Boston Marathon. A violent confrontation was initiated by the individual, the FBI said, without providing further details. So he turned violent, they claim, a violent confrontation, and then an imminent threat. Those are the words they use. Turned violent, imminent threat, violent confrontation. No details on what exactly he did. Did he have a weapon? I mean, again, think about this. If you're being brought in for questioning, you can pretty much assume you're going to go through a police metal detector, at the very least, if not a pat down, to get into the police headquarters. And this is FBI questioning in Orlando. I bet you they have an FBI field office there. Again, you're not getting in an FBI field office without being searched, pat down, at the very least, a metal detector. So you're not bringing any knives. You're not bringing any guns in there. And maybe they got a pencil on the table and the guy picked up a pencil. He's apparently was an MMA fighter, or he knew the guy from being involved. He knew Tamerlan from MMA related activities. Maybe he's a big guy. I don't have a picture of him. We could look it up and try to make it make sense. But I don't know. It's just very weird. Very weird. And this guy ends up dead. They said that he had been questioned at his apartment complex in Orlando several times by law enforcement since the day that the brothers were identified as the bombing suspect. And again, the brother died in a gunfight. The other one is found and is being charged with death penalty, and he's facing the death penalty. The other weird thing is that Tamerlan had been on a U.S. government database of potential terrorism suspects, and the U.S. had twice been warned by Russia that he might be an Islamic militant. This is being admitted. You can find this in some other documents, in one of the other articles I pulled up. The U.S. government itself acknowledged that Russian officials had warned them in the years before this that the brothers were potential radicals, you know, potential terror suspects, that they were, Russia didn't like them either because they saw them as like Chechen rebels, right? Maybe the U.S. didn't take it seriously. Maybe they saw them as an opportunity because, again, this is the way they manufacture terrorism, and they do manufacture terrorism by entrapping people. So I'm going to go ahead and use CIA Google right now. FBI Derek Bros Occupy. This is a two-part article series. Let's see if it comes up. There it goes. That I wrote together. Recent crimes of the FBI. Here, we'll just go here. I wrote this more than 10 years ago, when I wanted to call out what exactly I'm talking about. Here it is, two-part series. One is called Recent Crimes of the FBI, Is the Agency America's Greatest Threat to Domestic Freedoms? This is June 2014. Part two came a couple weeks later, Recent Crimes of the FBI, Who is Watching the Watchers? And that's a two-part series, but it points out, I go through here providing evidence of how the FBI entrapped people. Again, holding the FBI accountable for entrapment. You can find plenty and plenty of examples where it's a very thin line between alleged terrorists and then the FBI finding somebody who claims, I want to blow up something. Or, you know, they say some tough guy stuff on the internet, and they go find them and they give them the means to do what they may never have the opportunity to do. So, for example, somebody's like, oh, I'm so angry, I wish I could just blow up the government building. And they come find them and bring in an informant who gets to know them through the chat room. And sooner or later, they say, hey, man, I met a guy. And he says he can get us 6 boxes of C4 and blah, blah, whatever. You down? And then if the person expresses any interest or goes to a meeting or does even the slightest thing, has a phone call, the U.S. government believes that's enough evidence for them to them arrest somebody and call them a terrorist. And you could argue, well, Derek, if we didn't intervene, they would do it and it would be terrorism. Well, that's called pre-crime, and we're supposed to have rights in the United States and all over the world, regardless of the government. But the governments don't like to pay attention to that, right? So if we're supposed to have rights and we're supposed to have innocent until proven guilty, then governments should not be allowed to do pre-crime and try to entrap people to entice them to commit crimes that they may have never before committed. And the thing is, they specifically target people who are low income and who have very little resources, or, as I mentioned before, who get involved in criminal activity and then they need help, they need a way out. So they come dangle this fruit over their head and say, okay, you want out of this? Well, work for us and we'll do, you know, we'll get you where you want to be. Or, hey, you involved in a triple homicide? Well, we'll help you get out of that if you work for us, right? Now, this is another, we've talked so far about the drills. We've talked about the fact that one of the brothers has connections to the FBI as a potential informant. We've also now mentioned that the U.S. intelligence agencies were warning, Russian intelligence agencies were warning the U.S. about these two brothers for one reason or another. And it's enough to say that there are questions. Also, you go back to my video I played earlier. There was reports of different explosions taking place, other suspects. There was a Saudi man that was arrested in the beginning. And I understand that, you know, not everything that is reported in the beginning is going to be factual, especially if there's an alleged bomb going off or some kind of pyrotechnics. It's going to be chaotic. People are going to be scared. You can't count on every first-hand report you hear at the beginning. Things are going to change and evolve. I understand that. I get that. But there are still things that don't make sense about that day. This is an article from Global Research from Tony Cartolucci, who writes at the, or used to write, I don't know if he's still around, at the Land Destroyer, an article literally days after the event, April 2013. Shout out to Tony if you're still around for doing the good work literally right as it was happening a decade ago. Contractors at Boston Marathon bomb stood near bomb left before detonation. Now what they're talking about, I'm going to click on these pictures and we're going to look through them. You can see at the bottom of the screen, for those of you who are watching, there's this gentleman who's got a black jacket, khaki pants, and a black backpack. And you can see there's a white tip on the top of the handle of the backpack. And he's got short hair. And he also wears a baseball cap at some points. So there's this guy, and there's several of them, that just keep showing up in these scenes. And there are people who are looking at them after the event and trying to see what symbol was on their hat. There's suspicions that they were from Kraft International, which is like a private mercenary firm similar to Blackwater that I believe is based in Houston. And here's another picture. Here's the gentleman that we were talking about right there. You can see them to the right of the screen, khaki pants, jacket, phones. One's got a hat, the other one doesn't. And you can see, you know, you guys probably won't be able to see from your screen, but if you go look at the article and you zoom in, you can see the white tip on the top of the backpack is still there that we saw earlier. And you can see the other guy has a backpack in his hand still, which is kind of interesting. And this is where they were earlier. And this is where the bomb blast is supposed to have taken place. You can see them. There's somebody hurt here. That's at least what this picture is claiming. I'm not saying that's 100% factual, but that is what they're pointing at. It's like, hey, look, they were over here. After the explosion, two of the contractors are by the wall next to the bomb across the street, both using communication equipment. And here's another one. An unmarked SUV with a considerable amount of communication gear on the roof appears, surrounded by identically dressed men. The vehicle parks near the bleachers. Again, let's click in. You can see there's these guys still there on the phone. We got some unmarked other cop vehicle, satellites on top, and some more of these contractors or whoever they are, khaki, black jacket, some symbol, and there's more of them out here as well. Starting to pop up, starting to show up. What does it mean? So then we go on. Here's another one. You can see them getting into the bleachers over here, contractors and event staff by the bleachers. They're looking around. There they are there as well. Looking for more bombs, of course. People are being treated across the street. Obviously, you can suspect they probably think that there might be another bomb, or they believe there could be. Maybe they even found one. Because look, the next picture here says the men numbering between 6 and 8 then began tearing up the skirt around temporary bleachers erected for the event, opposite the explosion before taping it off. Then what appears to be an FBI bomb squad truck pulls up directly behind the contractor type SUVs, with the woman clearly wearing FBI on her tactical vest and emerging and speaking with contractors. Together, they disappear from the scene, leaving their vehicles behind. So let's check that one out. So this is the previous one. They're tearing up the bleachers. You got the one car right here that showed up a moment ago with communications equipment on its screen. And then right behind it, you get another vehicle shows up. So here's the unmarked car. That's definitely a woman wearing an FBI flak jacket. Maybe zoom in a little bit right there. She's there. The two men are there. There's other men. They look like they're pulling tables out. I mean, they could be pulling out rescue equipment. Again, I'm not claiming, oh, look, they found another bomb and they're getting rid of it. Some people suspect that. We don't have the evidence to prove it. The FBI truck and contractor SUV sit seemingly abandoned. Neither the FBI agent nor the contractors can be seen. What they did or where they went remains unknown so far. So yeah, you see this, like, people getting into the car, they went into this, maybe they went underneath there. I don't know if there's any more pictures. Obviously, at this point, they started clearing people off the scene and getting everybody the heck out of there. So questions that must be answered. The first question is, Who are these men with large black bags in the direct vicinity of the bomb, where the bomb would detonate, moving away before the blast and disappearing directly across the road? Who hired them and what was their function? Why were they moving amongst the crowd in a semi-covert fashion when all the other public servants were wearing proper uniforms and clearly identified? Did the police and other event organizers and medics know who these men were and what they were doing? Why did it appear the FBI was fully aware of their presence and, in fact, working with them, specifically with what looks like a bomb squad unit? And, you know, so this is worth reading. There's also, you can go, this link goes to 150 images of the Boston Marathon on Flickr that were saved at that time. So this is a good job somebody did compiling all that. If you want to go look through these, try to look for signs of fuckery or weirdness. You can see the guys that we were talking about. This is just all Boston Marathon. This is previous marathon stuff. Of course, it gets to the point where it explodes and things go totally different than people are expecting. But if you want to go through, you can dig through all those photos. Now, here's another one. Official story has odd wrinkles. A pack of questions about the Boston bombing backpacks. And this is another one from Who, What, Why. It basically covers what I went through, but in a little more detail. What they're looking at is like, look, we were told that these brothers used pressure cookers to set off these bombs. This person actually called to look into it and see where did the brothers allegedly buy their pressure cookers. And they looked at the backpacks and tried to use the images to locate the backpacks they may have been wearing, the real backpacks. Because, again, the only thing we've ever seen that implicates these brothers is some grainy old footage that shows them wearing backpacks. It doesn't. They supposedly, one of them confessed to it, although we're not allowed to talk to him. And when he first was arrested, he was drugged up and who knows what else, how many times he's been beaten. But this video is basically saying, like, look at the way the backpack slung off the shoulder. If that's full of a pressure cooker, you would notice it better. It would be easier to see, or these straps would be stretching, different things like that. Again, I don't know. Here's the backpack, though. One of the alleged backpacks, according to the FBI, that blew up with the pressure cooker. And some people are looking at this little piece here and they're like, look, that looks like the top of the strap that the other contractor had. Remember I showed you guys he had a little white square on the top of his backpack handle? I don't know. I'm not going to claim you can know for sure, but that's what some people suspect of it. And again, here's the guys. Here you can see his backpack handle. And Kraft is who they're suspected of being. This symbol over here on the right. Some people thought it's a Kraft symbol. I don't know that we can for sure prove that. Now, as I mentioned, and this article points out, when you look at the transcript of a hospital visit to Zokar in the Beth Israel Hospital by federal judge Maureen Bowler, who had finally called a halt to the interrogation, which was all conducted without a lawyer or witness present, you could tell how he was drugged up. She said, I'll ask the doctor whether or not the patient is alert. You can rouse him. Doctor said, how are you feeling? Are you able to answer some question? He nods. There follows a series of questions and answers between the judge and attorney, and then some questions to him, which are only answered by nods. And so this article is trying to say, like, look, it's clear he's not even barely present. Like, he doesn't know what's going on. So they also said that he admitted guilt, that he wrote, I don't know if you guys remember this, but he wrote his guilt on the boat where they found him in Watertown. I was in town during this lockdown, and they claimed he was hiding in the boat, and he must have wrote this note while he was hiding. And that's literally the evidence. I mean, there's no hard evidence linking them, and we can't talk to them because one of them died. Oh, and somebody who was his friend got killed in a questioning because he acted violent. And it's just, it gets weirder and weirder, guys. But I want to end this report with a different focus. This is an article written by, or a reference to an article written by Ron Paul, former Congressman Ron Paul, in 2013. Ron Paul, shut down after Boston bombings, more frightening than the attack itself. Ron Paul slams the police response to the Boston bombings. Liberty was also attacked in Boston, he said. And this is a quote from Ron Paul's article at that time. Forced lockdown of a city. Militarized police riding tanks in the streets. Door-to-door armed searches without warrant. Families thrown out of their homes at gunpoint to be searched without probable cause. Businesses forced to close. Transport shut down. These were not the scenes from a military coup in a far-off banana republic, but rather the scenes just over a week ago in Boston as the U.S. got a taste of martial law. The ostensible reason for the military-style takeover of parts of Boston was that the accused perpetrator of a horrific crime was on the loose. The Boston bombing provided the opportunity for the government to turn what should have been a police investigation into a military-style occupation of an American city. This unprecedented move should frighten us as much or more than the attack itself. And as I said in the video, and you saw my video, I mean, you can go look up, for those who weren't around or paying attention at the time, go look at the Boston bombing lockdown. Just look up. I mean, it was a ghost town, guys. It was honestly pretty terrifying to be walking through with Cody filming, and just there was people peeking out their doors like, stay yubber, stay safe. And, you know, we're like, hey, we're out here documenting, and people were scared. And you can see in the video, we get questioned by cops. This was a test run for martial law in the U.S. This is what matters. So if you're hearing this video and you're like, Derek, you're reaching. Who cares if there were drills before? Who cares if there was some weird thing about a triple homicide or somebody they knew was killed during questioning? These guys admitted to it. They had backpacks on. We never actually saw them drop off the bombs, but we know they did it. Even if you believe that, the point is, the Boston bombing, like most of the false flags that have taken place since before and since 9/11, have been used to justify more government control. Now, in the past, they've used things like the threat of international terrorism or Islamic terrorism, and now these days it's more about the threat of pandemics or now climate lockdowns or alien invasion. But the point is, no matter what, governments will use these crises, which they often manufacture or they allow to fester until they become a real problem, so they can take advantage of them. Rahm Emanuel, you never want to let a good crisis go to waste. Remember that. We heard that during the Obama administration, and it continues. So even if you don't believe that there was some sort of planning or organization behind the Boston Marathon bombing, without a doubt, the U.S. government and the law enforcement were ready to roll out the police state and to use the LRED sound cannon and to use the Humvees and to use the drones and the spy equipment and soon the robo dogs. So we need to be aware of that, guys. It's been 10 years now since the Boston Marathon bombing. It's mostly passed without too many people paying attention to it. The brother, one of the living brothers, still locked up in the maximum security prison and unable to be spoken to. It's really crazy stuff, man. I want to show one other thing that I'm glad I just remembered before I wrap up, because I know some of you will point this out. Now, there's this woman, this doctor named Liana Nguyen, that you all probably know from just her driving us crazy the last couple years during COVID and speaking all sorts of insane stuff about forcing people to be vaccinated and just all the worst things, right? Well, when you go back and you look up Liana Nguyen, this Dr. Liana Nguyen, she was actually present in Boston at the marathon, which is just another weird factor of this whole thing. There she is right there. This is a report from CNN. 20,000 views 9 years ago. Doctor treated Boston victims. Worried husband was one. Dr. Liana Nguyen. I don't know what it means. Maybe she's just been kicking ass as a doctor for 10 years. So, of course, now she's in a position where when it's COVID time, they're going to look to her as a doctor for advice. Could be the case. I'm not saying she's a crisis actor. I'm not saying she was involved in the Boston Marathon bombing. I'm just saying that's weird. That's weird. It's weird that she happened to be there on the scene of the crime. Claimed her husband might have been one of the victims, you know, really hyped up the fear about the Boston bombing, and then 10 years later is speaking out and playing a role in the COVID lie. Just something to also think about. But I think that's where I'm going to leave it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this. Again, thank you to everybody who continues to support my work. And if you can, please share this video. Go look at all the articles and the videos that are linked. If you have the ability to, please support the Conscious Resistance Network, guys. Because of people like you and all of you out there who pay attention to my work over the last 14 years, I'm able to go on events like go to the Boston Marathon bombing, to go speak at places in person, to go to Austin to question Chris Hedges and Tulsi Gabbard and things like that. So really, truly, my friends, I depend on your support. I get paid for my articles at The Last American Vagabond, but beyond that, I am not paid for any of the work I do. If you want to sign up for monthly support, support me at Buy Me a Coffee, send checks, cash, or equipment to our P.O. box, buy shirts, support us how you can. And until next time, my friends, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace.
Since 2012, the Conscious Resistance Network has been an independent media organization focused on empowering individuals through education, philosophy, health, and community organizing. We work to create a world where corporate and state power do not rule over the lives of free human beings. Our motto is leading by example and helping others in their pursuit of freedom. Visit theconsciousresistance.com to find our articles, documentaries, interviews, podcasts, books, and more. Remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free.